As I've said before about that chant, where it says the Dharma is rarely encountered, even in millions of ages, one of my teachers, Bernie Glassman, likes to point out that that is not true. It's always encountered. It's encountered every second, but we don't see it. That's the difference, right? So he changed it in his sangha to always encountered but rarely seen, or something like that. So always encountered. You know, so what is the Dharma, and what is we're always encountering and we're not seeing? And that's continuing on from what we were saying yesterday, and with my initial desire to talk about Dogen. And some of his famous teachings, which are all about that the Dharma is right here and now. This, your life, everything is it, and we just don't realize it, right? So there's just two things going on all the time. And yesterday when we talked about both the Odyssey and Joyce's Ulysses, they're all about that too. That the every moment, everything in your life is the supreme way, is the enlightened way, is the Buddha way, is the teaching. All it's one. So even like yesterday when I said the throne of enlightenment is right here, it's where you're sitting. It's not even that. It's you are the throne of enlightenment. There's a place where Dogen says something about enlightenment is right beneath your feet. And then he goes on to correct that and say, it's not beneath your feet, it is your feet. It's your hands. It's your original face. It is this. It's not like something else, you're sitting on it, you're behind it, it's in front of you. So when we say it's rarely encountered, it's we're not seeing what is right in front of us, which is us. It's that close, what we're talking about here. So we won't go back into the Odyssey and Joyce directly, like we did yesterday. A couple of points, though, that we didn't address so clearly was this notion of killing, when we talked about killing, and there was this suggestion that Catherine had heard in a history class about how Mao saying, you have to kill the rich people, or something. It was Mao, right?
He didn't say it, he did it.
Okay, well, whatever, yeah. But that was Mao that you were referring to, yeah. And so this is like a gross misunderstanding, you know, surprising from a Chinese guy who supposedly is steeped in Confucianism, Taoism, Buddhism, right? But because it's not, that's like killing the messenger or something, you know? The point is, in our practice, we go to the root of that, what causes it? What's the root cause is, in the case of capitalism, you know, which he was referring to, greed. And our fundamental, that's one of the three poisons, greed, anger, and ignorance, right? So greed is attachment. We say that in our meal chant, right? Say, because we desire the natural order of mind to be free from clinging, we must be free from greed. So greed comes from clinging. Clinging to what? Well, clinging to anything. We cling to anything we can get our hands on, right? Or get our mind on. And it's so deeply ingrained that it's extremely difficult to even get our mind around. And our mind can never get it. It can only be experienced. So when we fully realize that this clinging to this identity when we see through it, then we can become free of it, right? So Mao saying, let's kill the rich people, well, he's missing the point. It's not the rich people who are the problem. It's what drives us to want to become rich and exploit and deprive others and not share and not see the oneness and all of that. That root needs to be killed, something like that, we could say. And it's not even killing this way. I said, De Juan, well, how are you defining killing? And I know that he was talking about, we were talking about in the relative world, these, you know, about different visions and competing visions and, you know, this conundrum of the trolley. Is that what it was? The trolley epic thing? Yeah, right. But these are all, you know, these are all relative world issues that we're dealing with, okay? The thing is that what Dogen is telling us, and so we'll get to that today, that the relative world is where our enlightened way is. So how do we approach all of these issues that were brought up from the enlightened, from our enlightened life, right? How do we do this? And that's what our whole practice is about. As we said yesterday about killing, you know, so we can take the example of cancer, for example. So we all have these cancer cells in our body all the time. Sometimes they come together and they do bad things to us, right? Cancer cells. And so we've adopted these techniques where massive killing. So we kill other parts of our organism in order to get rid of those cancer cells, right? And some people die from the treatment that they've been given to be cured of cancer, right? I just read this book of, you know, the author Paul Auster, the novelist, Paul Auster, and his wife, who's also a novelist writer, and she has just written a memoir about his, about their life together and his process of cancer and dying. And, you know, goes through just horrible things with the cancer treatment. And essentially, if they didn't stop the treatment, he would have died of the treatment. So it was, well, he's going to die anyway. Do you really want to keep going on through this treatment, or do you want to just die of the cancer? Exactly. So, and we know many stories of this. So this is an example of we kill in order to save. In order to live, we have to kill, right? We know this because we have to eat. We have cells in our body that are constantly regenerating, dying and regenerating. There are some traditions that take this literally, this thing of not killing, this precept that we have. And so therefore, you know, they have to repent for stepping on organisms they don't even know are there on the ground. Because they're walking on the ground, they're killing the organisms on the ground, right? We can all do that. And in the full moon ceremony tonight, it's really a ceremony of atonement and repentance and acknowledging what our life is and expressing our atonement for whatever we might have done that is killing that life, our life and the life of others. So this notion of killing, it goes in, you know, a thousand directions, but it also goes to the very basic essence of what our practice is about. The fundamental point, right? And that brings us to Dogen, as I said yesterday, was a teacher, a master in the 13th century in Japan, but he had gone to China and met a teacher there and received his Dharma transmission in China and brought back the Chinese version of Buddhism, which was called Chan, to Japan, and that became Zen. So he's a founding ancestor, as I said. And his teachings are, he wrote them in a collection of chapters, or fascicles, as they're called, 95 of them, in what's called the Shobogenzo. And this is like the great literature of Japanese Zen, Shobogenzo. And the first chapter of that is called the Genjo Koan, which I said to you yesterday, he wrote for a lay practitioner. Mm-hmm. He wrote, it was a letter that he sent to a lay practitioner, was not nominally addressed to his monks, who had, you know, taken vows to leave the worldly world and were living collectively in, you know, a monastic environment. So we're symbolically doing that. We've left the worldly world for this week, and we're living in this collective environment, which is devoted to practice. We're giving ourselves entirely to our practice this week, which is what monks supposedly would do in monasteries. And he was writing this letter to a layperson. So what does this mean? What is it about? It's where that famous quote that we always talk about of to study the way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be enlightened by the 10,000 things. That's just one part of this famous passage that comes in the Genjo Koan. Some people say that should have been the first paragraph of the text, but it's not. It's farther down in the text. But that paragraph is a capsule of the whole teaching of Dogen, right? And of our practice, actually. This is how it applies to us. So the Genjo Koan basically means, so Genjo means phenomena, all phenomena, whether physical, mental, whatever, all phenomena. And koan, which we know from our practice, koan is a Japanese word that is like an official document or an official case. Like in our legal systems, we have case law. So we have cases that are referred to as authority, right? And that's what koans are. They're cases that are, that's what a koan is. In Japanese legal system and in Japanese society, that's what a koan is. In our practice, we use that word because we have these cases, stories, poems, quotes, that serve as official authoritative cases of someone's awakening or awakening to a key to awakening. Awakening meaning to awakening to the oneness of life, to the oneness aspect. We're very familiar with the multitude life, right? The differences. The world of form, that's where we live, we're very familiar with that. What we need to open our eyes to is this other aspect of life, which is the absolute, the oneness, the non-form. And these cases, these koans, help us to realize that. Now in Genjo Koan, so he's saying, the title of this text is the Genjo Koan, it's the phenomenon, and koan, the absolute, you know, the absolute authority of Dharma, of the Buddha Dharma, something like that. But what it means is that let's see, how could I say this? It's about realizing the absolute, so the koan realm, in the relative realm. So it's about realizing this oneness right here now in your everyday life. That's what the Genjo Koan is about. That's what the title means. I'm just making sure I didn't have some better definition of it that I wrote down. You know, it's to experience the true reality through the practice of everyday activity. That's what Genjo Koan means. And that's what the whole text is about. And in fact, you know, in a sense, the whole Shobo Genzo, all of his teachings come around to that. And this is, you know, this is something that's very familiar to us as Western practitioners because, you know, we have these books like the famous book by Joko Beck, Everyday Zen. You know, we say your practice is your life and your life is your practice. We live as lay people, so we're asked all the time to, you know, practice as lay people in the worldly world with our jobs and our families and our activities with friends and whatever it is we do. We're familiar with the famous, another famous layperson, Layman Pang, who was in China, of chopping wood, carrying water. Just that is the Buddha way. Chopping carrots, cooking, cleaning, everything is it. We're familiar with that, more or less. That's the way that we practice. And in our Sangha, it's even to a further extent because we don't have a fixed place of practice. So wherever we are is the place of practice. You know, wherever we are, we move in and we make it the zendo. Some communities have a fixed zendo that's arranged, you know, specific organization, and the practice happens there. We also, my choice was to remove formal robes and to practice in everyday clothing, because that, for me, reflects more who we are in the way that we practice. Not wearing monk robes or even Japanese robes, even if they're not monk's robes. I didn't have monk's robes, but I had the Japanese robes. So in the West, we're moving, with every generation, we're moving in that direction anyway. But it's thanks to Dogen that we can even do it. And this was, you know, 7-8 centuries ago. He's the one who laid the groundwork for this, that is allowing us to practice the way we practice today. And then each successive generation has to embody it. Otherwise, if you just read it in a book, it's meaningless. It's really hard to read Dogen. You know, some people have, you've been reading Dogen. It's not easy to read Dogen because it's just like, what is he talking about? You know, it's like, really, wow. Beautiful poetic language, but you can't understand it, you know. Even to study the way is to study the self. Well, okay, maybe we can get that. To study the self is to forget the self. What does that mean, you know? To forget the self is to be enlightened by the 10,000 things. What does that mean, you know? So reading it is one thing. Then hearing, discussing, having a transmission of it from someone who is supposedly embodying it is another thing. And then receiving that and embodying it yourself, that is the jewel. That's what we all need to do. And there's no replacement for that. Everything we, all of our setup here, as Joa Sensei likes to call it, the setup, is intended to make it possible for that jewel to emerge. You already are that jewel, but you don't see it. You don't know it. Maybe you do, but sometimes you don't, right? So sometimes you do, sometimes you don't. Our practice is all geared to help that jewel emerge. And that was Dogen's intention with this text to this lay practitioner who maybe had come to the temple, to the monastery, and was discouraged because could not leave home, work, family, and had the impression that they could not realize these teachings in their daily life. And probably out of his great compassionate wisdom, Dogen gave him this text. I think it was a man. I'm quite sure it was a man that he gave it to. And telling him, you can do it. You can. It's not, you don't have to leave where you are, put on special clothing, shave your head, give up all your possessions. It's like, you don't have to kill the rich people, right? You don't have to kill the worldly world. In fact, there's no point in killing the worldly world. It's what is causing us the suffering in the worldly world that needs to be dealt with. And what's causing us suffering in the worldly world is that the same thing that's causing the monks suffering in their monastic world is this attachment to self, this belief, this misguided impression that we are a fixed identity separate from others. And that that's the root of all of it, right? Then everything else comes from that. So he's telling this guy, you don't, that's not the problem where you live. It's not the problem what your life looks like. Probably once you realize who you truly are, when you make that homecoming, like we talked about yesterday, when you truly come home to yourself, then probably the way you live will change. Because you will see things, it will become simpler, because you will see things that you don't need anymore. You don't need to, like, create this huge persona on Instagram, because you see that already the persona that you've been dragging around all these years, well, that's not who you truly are. You may not feel that you need to be, you know, caught up in the rat race of some job that doesn't suit you. You may decide that you can do a different kind of work. Or you may be much more relaxed about raising your children because you see that that's the practice. Changing diapers, putting food on the table for the family, that is the practice. That is the Dharma. That is it. So then your relationship to that changes. Like I have often said, that my relationship to my work as a journalist was completely changed when I started doing this practice. Completely. I still worked as a journalist for 34 years. But the way that I approached it and the way that I functioned with my colleagues and with my work was completely different. So it's not necessarily that you, and probably my colleagues at my office, many of them didn't notice any difference, maybe. Or maybe they did and they didn't know what was happening. One thing I did was I started working part-time instead of full-time. Partly because I had a family, but partly because I didn't want to do that with all, I didn't want to spend my, you know, the best days, hours, minutes, years of my life doing that. And it meant, of course, less money, which then meant I would live differently. But that was fine, because what was important for me was not to have a lot of money. And because I didn't have as much money, I didn't have the same clothes. But I didn't need the same clothes because I wasn't going to the office all the time. When I was working full-time, I had to pay a lot of money to babysitters. So I had to make a lot of money. Well, since I wasn't going to the office as much, I didn't need to pay as much for a babysitter, so I didn't need the same amount of money. You see how it all goes together, right? And all of this was practice. All of this is practice. It's not like just some, you know, life changes that you are contemplating for because you want to... you want to get rid of your big apartment or something, or you hate your boss or something like that. I mean, this is like deeply spiritual choices that we make when we realize who we truly are. It's interesting that monks, so they have a ceremony which is called a home leaving ceremony. So they leave their homes. They abandon, you know, the worldly life. They leave their apartments, their jobs, their families, whatever it was. Give up their cars, everything, all their possessions, and move to a monastery. So they leave home so that they don't formulate it this, but so that they can come to their true home, right here. So that they can devote their entire lives to waking up to this. Whereas in the worldly world, we are asked to not leave our homes, but go completely into them. Give yourself entirely to your life as it is. The monks give themselves entirely to the life as theirs is. We in the worldly world give ourselves entirely to this life that is ours. As it is. Genjo Kōen is telling us. This is what he's saying. So, you know, the true reality through the practice of everyday activity. That is it. So he goes through it. I'm just going to talk about the title today because when we start getting into the text, it gets complicated, you know. So, you know, as I said, the Buddha way is right here beneath your feet. So not only is he talking about the entire phenomenal world being the living Buddha way, but the whole phenomenal world is entirely you. So there's two things going on. So you see the absolute oneness of everything being the Buddha way, everything in your life. But everything in your life is you. So this is another step that we have to take. Everything in your life is you. Everything, you know, the worker, the pounding, the floor, the water, the sun, the moon, the waves, all of it is you. We can say it's all, you know, the Dharma, it's all the manifestations of the Absolute, and it's all you, because you too are that. We do this when we work with Mu, we look at this, right? So if you've worked with Mu, you're familiar with this. So the Genjo Koan, the title of it is, there's different translations, actualizing reality is one of them. Actualizing means to like make it actual, make it alive, the absolute reality, make it alive here now. Or actualizing the fundamental point. So the fundamental point being oneness. This is it, right here now. Everything is it. So it's about actualizing that. And then there's two sets of dialectics sometimes going on through his teaching, right? So there's this one of the absolute and the relative. So there's the absolute world of oneness, and then there's the relative world of forms. And he's constantly going back and forth between those two, and he's saying our everyday life, which is the world of form, is also the absolute. So it's about realizing that in our everyday life. So that's that dialectic. He's constantly going back and forth. And the other dialectic, he's talking about the intrinsic side of enlightenment, or inherent, which means you already are that. You already are enlightened. Like I said, you already are the jewel. And the experiential side, which is practice and realization. So it means nothing if we don't put it into practice and realize it here and now in our lives for each of us. So he's constantly going back and forth with these two different dialectics. So from the inherent, you know, side, that's our essential identity. That is our basic nature, our essence, I'll get to that next. And from the experiential side, we need to thoroughly integrate that realization of the inherent essential identity, okay? So when I'm constantly saying, who are you? Who am I? That we're looking into, not who am I in from the relative view, it's who am I essentially? What is my original self? My original face, my original mind? Who is that? And that is the ultimate question and the ultimate koan. I say that because that was what my story was. That was what brought me to this practice. That was my question. But it also is a question for everyone. Because if you see that, you've seen everything. That's the single teaching of the Buddha, right? If you've seen that, you've seen everything, and then it's a question of actualizing it, bringing it into your everyday life. So there's the intrinsic self, that original self. It's there. It is. We just don't see it. And then there's the experiential side of awakening, which is, so first we need to awaken to this intrinsic self, and then we need to develop that and realize it in our daily lives, which is then the, you know, actualization, realization, or awakening, or something like that. And that's what he's talking about in this Genjo Koans. That's what we do. And he outlines how it works and what it means and everything. So now there's this Tibetan teacher, Anan Tuptam, who said this, you know, thing where, where was it? Where the, so this form, this relative self that we're talking about, that we know very well, you know, we know who we are, we know our age, we know our weight, we know our job, we know our history, our parents, all that stuff. We know this really well. That self is impermanent, though. It's changing all the time, right? Someone said to me yesterday, it's like a river. So it's changing all the time. Every minute, like we said, you know, the cells are regenerating. we're not who we were 1 minute ago. Everything has changed right now. It's changed from when I first said that. Everything is constantly changing. Endless, endless change, impermanence, impermanent. That's the nature of this world, of this relative world, impermanence. However, I thought this was really interesting, this Anam Tupten, who I read, he said, your relative self that you're familiar with is impermanent. But your Buddha nature, your essential self, who you truly are, is not impermanent. Never changes. It's always there. It's like we said about the moon. It's always there. The sun, it's always there. There's the clouds that cover it up, but the sun is there. On the airplane, you go above the clouds, and there's the sun. When you were down in this cloudy, ugly gray day on the ground, and you go above the... and there's the sun, like, radiant, you know? That's a metaphor, of course, because the sun and the moon, and these are phenomenal, part of the phenomenal world, and they're impermanent, but we use that as a metaphor. So this unchanging, basic, true self, that's who you truly are. And when you realize that, then that changes how you experience this impermanent, constantly changing me. You see that that is just a manifestation in the form, the world of form, of who you truly are, of this basic nature of all phenomena, right? Something like that. And as Dogen points out in his text, that without the realization of your true original self, or that everything is you, this, what he calls the great mind of compassion, or what we can call the unconditioned, undifferentiated true self, it will not appear. It's there, but it won't appear if we haven't realized who we truly are. So you can hear about it. You can hear me talk about it. It's just a bunch of words. I'm just like telling you all these words, right? It's true. It's just words. It means nothing unless you realize it yourself. And that was one of the Buddha's basic teachings too, was don't believe me. Find out for yourself. Go look. Find it, you know? And Dogen is inciting us to do this. Look into your everyday life. Everything in your life is the living Buddha way. It is the teaching. The subjective realm, and the objective realm, and, you know, the self and all things, that's together, they are the Dharma, the true way, something like that. True used not as opposed to false. True in the sense of like whole, entire, unaltered, something like that. Not as opposed to false. True and false are entirely part of the formal, the world of form, the relative world. Absolutely. We have to come up with some word, so we use true to say, when we're talking about true way, true self, true dharma, what is it that he says about true dharma? That because Shobo Genzo, so the title of Shobo Genzo, of the whole 95 chapters, is the treasury of the true Dharma eye. True in this sense is absolute. The true absolute eye, okay? Not opposed to a false Dharma eye. It's the true, it's the world of absolute equality, like I said yesterday. And the Dharma I, so the true I is the absolute, and the Dharma I is the relative. So the I that sees the relative world is the Dharma I. The I that sees the absolute is the true I. So he's saying this is the treasury of the true Dharma I. And this is taken from, taken from one of the original things that in the Zen tradition, the first transmission was when the Buddha, Shakyamuni, who was a living, breathing person like us, transmitted to his first successor, Mahakashyapa. And, he holds up a flower, this perfect manifestation of the relative world, which we know has bloomed and will fall. This is like the perfect manifestation of the relative world. And yet, when you realize that it's also a manifestation of the absolute world, well, then that's what we call awakening, right? So he holds this up in front of the whole assembly, and this guy sitting, his student in the front, smiles. And this is taken as he saw it. He got it. That this flower, this perfect example of the phenomenal, impermanent, relative world, is also the embodiment of the absolute, undifferentiated, unchanging absolute, right? So when he does this, the Buddha then gives him the flower and says, I now give to you, it's this real kind of flowery language, I now transmit to you the treasury of the true Dharma eye, something like this. And Dogen then takes that and uses it at the title of his text. But it's interesting that it's a flower that is, the whole story turns around this flower that he just holds up. He doesn't say anything. He just holds up the flower. It's not a mistake that our Sangha is called the Wildflower Sangha, right? It's not a coincidence. Because that's it. It's it right there. The whole teaching is in the name of our Sangha, right? And the way that we manifest it. A lot of Sanghas are given the name of the place where they are. Well, because we don't have a place. We had to reflect who we are, what our way is, and it's this wild flower way. When we were doing the walking in the Kinyan this morning and we came up those steps there, right there, I don't know if anyone else saw it, there's these amazing little tiny flowers growing through the cracks of those steps, and I just was just so moved by that, because that is who we are. We're like growing in these cracks, You know, we're coming alive in these cracks with all of the stuff we have to live with and our, you know, this impermanent being of ours which gets sick and old and dies and loss and love and beauty and ugliness and all this stuff we have, you know. That is the way. All of that is the way. All of that is a manifestation of the absolute oneness, of absolute reality, something like that. And that's where, we won't go back into it today, but that's where the Odyssey and Joyce's Ulysses, that is their story. That is what they tell. So neither Bloom in Ulysses or Odysseus in the Odyssey is a perfect saint. You know, these are not like impeccable beings. They have their weaknesses. They have their difficulties. They embody where they are in their moment, in time and place, in the relative world. And yet, they both are able to realize in their own ways, in their time and place, this absolute reality, something like that. And there are many, many other stories of this too. Last night I was trying to think, so, you know, I'm talking about Joyce and Homer all the time. There's got to be other stories. There are other stories. And the reason that, for example, Homer, the reason those stories have gone on for like 2,500 years or however long they are, is because there is a truth in them. It's not just because they're an adventure story that people like to hear. There is a truth there that transcends time and place. And the same with Joyce's Ulysses, which is a really difficult book to read. But there, and part of the reason that it has managed to survive and that people still pay attention to it and read it and talk about it is because there is this really deep, basic spiritual truth in it. And there are many other stories like that. You know, I mean, you look at the other sacred books, the Bible or the Bhagavad Gita or the Quran or, you know, the Torah. They all have these basic timeless teachings in them that transcend the time and place but are about who we are here and now, wherever we are. And Dogen's the same way. It's about who we are now. And that's the beauty of his Genjo Koan for that reason. I found this in this book that I have about this text. And so I found this note that I had put in there that, because I mean, I studied this text in the Dana study group, you know, I think in 2004 probably, something like that. It was one of the first books we studied. And I dream of studying it in our study group, but we haven't gotten there yet. But so this note is like from that, at least 20 years ago, right? And the pencil part, I can't read anymore. I don't know what it says. But the pen part, one of the pen parts says, and I don't think this was me who wrote it, I think it was a quote from someone, but even though the fact of no self, nothing, or true self, we could say, or like, you know, Odysseus, nobody, yesterday, nobody, even though the fact of that becomes visible with the enlightened eye, so even though we wake up to that fact, to who we truly are, it's not who we think we are, to our true original self, even though we awaken to that, how much has that person become that no self? How much has that become who we are and manifesting in the world? Even though the fact that self and others are one becomes visible with the enlightened eye. So even though that, too, we've awakened to that, we see that we are not separate. It's a question of whether one's daily activity expresses the oneness of self and other. So this is interesting because our daily life, our daily activity, how much do we express the oneness of self and other in everything we do, wherever we are? That's the key. That's the whole point. You know, like Maizumi Roshi, our ancestor, used to say, it's easy to wake up. It's easy. We don't think it is, but that's the easy part, right? At some point, this accident happens, and suddenly we're like, oh, wow, yes. I see the oneness, okay? Wow. That's the easy part. The hard part is whether one's daily activity expresses that here and now, right? And, you know, teachers say they can see a person's, one of my husband's previous teachers, Lama Surya Das, who's a lama in the U.S., said, I can't, you know, he was like this guy who, like, he would go with my husband and his friend, and when he was in Paris, and they would go get ice cream, and they would hang out. And Joa Sensei also has a place in his heart for Lama Surya Das, because he knew him like that, too. So, you know, it wasn't like they were sitting and doing, like, deep Tibetan teachings and things like that. And he said to them once, I can tell where somebody is in their practice by how they behave with children. And this is really interesting, right? How, and it's not if you have children or not, but it's kind of a very telling example of how we are embodying our experience of self and other with a child. And he didn't go into details about, I think they were sitting somewhere in a park and they were observing how people were behaving with the children in the park or something. And he could see where people were. And he related that to practice, right, to our practice. Or the story that I also like to tell that comes from Bernie Glassman of a somewhere, I think it comes from, you know, Rabbi Nachman, the guy in 18th century Poland or something, who had these, you know, yeshiva students, these students of a rabbi, and some great rabbi, some high authority, was going to be visiting and giving teachings in a town like 300 kilometers away. And they all really wanted to go, but they couldn't afford all to go, so they put their money together, and one of them was chosen to go to make the voyage, one of the students, one of the young men, to go see this teacher. So he makes the voyage, he walks there, takes him days to get there, and arrives, stays for like a day, even though this is like going on for weeks or something, stays for like a day and then comes back. And so the other guys are like, wow, what did he say? What was he teaching? And he said, well, I don't really know what he said, but I just wanted to see how he tied his shoes. Which is quite an amazing thing, right? That the words are not it, right? It's how the person manifests. Mm-hmm. So he focused on tying the shoes. Probably there was other stuff, too, he wanted to see. But how much care did he put in tying his shoes? Whatever this young man attached to the idea of tying his shoes, something of that he saw, and that was enough. He got the teaching in the tying of the shoes. Now, it doesn't mean that the person, I mean, you all know me, I'm certainly not a saint, right? So it's not that you have to look at all the aspects of the life and say the person is perfect. I know for a fact from people who lived with him that one of Bernie Glassman's great joys was to sit and get in his bed at night and eat ice cream watching stupid stuff on the television, you know? Stupid stuff, which, you know, probably a series, you know, in those days it was X-Files or something, I don't know. He also loved sports. Well, here's another teacher who likes sports, right? So I love tennis. I love football. I even, you know, when it's the Tour de France, I really like the Tour de France, you know? So, but these are just, for me, they're just manifestations of the one, right? These are just different ways of expressing the one. And seeing the, you know, there's something in the when the form of whatever these disciplines is, when it is thoroughly integrated and thoroughly embodied, whether it's, you know, kicking the football, stroking the tennis ball, riding the bicycle, whatever it is, then this is like an absolute manifestation of this practice, of the way, right? We can pick on any kind of discipline. You know, it can be cooking, it can be art. I love art, you know. I'm constantly going to museums and theater and cinema. I don't have at all the musical knowledge of this man.
No.
And I don't have the appreciation for it. But when people share their appreciation, when he shares stuff about it, when people, you know, I totally get it, you know. Or performers, you know, musicians who perform, I totally get it. And in the place where my mother lives, in a retirement home, and she lives in the part of the retirement home that is for people who are losing their, you know, faculties, their memory. She's not as far advanced as some of them in that loss, but there are two people there who are pretty far advanced, and yet they are musicians. The guy still plays the ukulele like unbelievable. And the woman can sit down and play amazing, you know, Mozart sonatas. Unbelievable. So there's something, there's an expression of the true self in that that is beyond our memory and our, you know, formless, our form, our worldly expression, you know. I imagine that at some point the ukulele and the piano will be lost, but I don't know. You know, I don't know. Or when I was there with my mother recently and with my daughter, and they had an activity in the afternoon where musicians would come and perform and have sing-along for the people and things like that. These people, you know, these are like American folk songs. It happened to be around the 4th of July, so that's the big American holiday. And these are songs that every American child learns, you know, and sings all the time. These people who are like more than 80 years old and who are, you know, not really there in a lot of ways, they could sing along no problem. They knew the words. They sang along joyously, you know, singing this stuff that they knew when they were children. They can't tell you what happened yesterday, or even they don't remember who you are, but they know there's something deep, spiritual even, about this true being, you know. So it's, you know, I don't know where I got this quote. I'm sure it wasn't me because that's not really my language, but, or maybe it is because I was really into no self at the time. So how much have you become that no self? How much have you become that true self? And how do your daily activities express that? Between self and other, you know, how do you treat other people? Surya Das said children, but we can say anyone, right? So the whole Genjo Koan is about that. I think that's why I put that there. I don't know about that. This other stuff. But anyway, you know how that is when you have notes and books and stuff. So. So maybe I will stop there. Why are you laughing?
It's interesting. Like two kids playing around.
Oh, you're both laughing about something?
No, it was not about you.
But it was something to do with what we're talking about.
No? Everything is.
Exactly. So that's wonderful. That too is the Dharma, you know? That too is expressing the true Dharma right now. Doesn't matter what it was about, but everything's connected. So earlier I was thinking about while we were sitting and they were pounding, right? And so can we include that? The pounding, the workers, you know, can we include that? We have this wonderful koan of how do you stop the sound of the distant temple bell? Right? Well, so, you know, you go through all this stuff. Well, you know, I go there and I stop it. I tell them to stop ringing it and all this stuff. Well, no, that's not it, guys. I'm not it. So how do you stop the pounding? It's not like you wait till their lunch break. Or as Lisa and I were arriving, we were saying, the workers haven't been here today. As soon as we sat down, they started setting up and pounding, right? So, you know, what is that? That, too, is part of the phenomenal world. That, too, is an expression of absolute reality. That, too, is, this is a way to realize our way. You know, sitting with the sound of the pounding of insulation that they're putting on the walls, styrofoam.
We should definitely invite them for the brunch, though, because they will have been part of the retreat, really.
Sure, they're here Monday morning, and they can take a break at that time, yeah. Because they are in the retreat with us, you know. They are. They're part of our retreat. And that's what we used to do with our Heart of Life retreats was we were all at home doing our thing, going to work, whatever we were doing, and we were on retreat together, and everyone we were interacting with was also part of the retreat because we were on retreat. So they were too. They were part of it. They didn't know it. They weren't thinking of it in those terms. But for us, they were in the retreat. Can we include them in the retreat? So, I'll stop, yes.
So, when you say that everything is in our life, is this connected with this also idea of every single person is a reflection and the way we respond is a projection of our inner world? So if there's someone who is being nasty with us or whatever, in the Tibetan tradition they call it the sublime teacher.
Sublime teacher.
So it's like someone is telling us that we need to change or that we need to do something to change that reality or to be kinder if we are encountering someone that mistreats us. It's in that way that also you are talking when everything is part in our life is a reflection of our true self.
Well, you know, I'm not so familiar with the Tibetan teaching, but in the sense that everything is a teaching, everything is a manifestation of absolute reality, something like that, and we can see it as not... the person has their anger or their behavior, it belongs to them, that's what they're doing. How do we receive that? How do we behave with that? How do we react to that? That belongs to us, to our, you know, being. And then if we took it, you know, if we came to the when we realize the true essential being, then we don't even react in the same way. It can help us to connect with who our true being is if we look into it in that way. But we won't respond in the same way if we see who we truly are and who they truly are. Because when we see who we truly are, we see who they truly are, and we see it's just a manifestation of their, you know, worldly being or something, and has to do with all their karma and all of our karma. The fact that we're meeting here right now, our karma has brought us here to this moment. The karma of our relative being has brought us here to this moment. So we're connected, no matter what it is. And so we can look into, well, what is my part in that? What is their part in that? But ultimately, our true being is not affected by that. It's untouched. That's what allows us to then not be attached to it, that we're not, you know, blaming the person or attacking them for treating us this way because we're not attached to it. It doesn't really have anything to do with who I truly am. And yet it has to do with my manifestation in the world, my being in the world, my worldly form. But as I said earlier, my worldly manifestation changes when I have realized who I truly am, something like that. Mm-hmm. I think it's the same thing, you know, they're saying. And it's, you know, we use that example of Indra's net, which there's, you know, it's a net that, this is an image that comes from traditional Indian teachings of Indra, you know, the great being, the god of the universe or something, has it through, makes a net that is all over the whole universe. And it's connected, each part of the section of the net is connected with a jewel. And each jewel, so there's, you know, there's jewels at each intersection, and each jewel reflects every other jewel. And so every jewel is reflecting all of the jewels, and yet it's just it's one jewel. So in that sense, it's a reflection. It's true.
Of our
of who we are. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So absolutely. It was in that sense.
Yeah, yeah.
It's absolutely. Not only the problem, it's not only our karma, but it's also a reflection of
exactly.
something that
is here now. Yeah, exactly, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
And of course, the Christian expression of that is this famous. I think it's the Christian, sorry. The most obvious Christian way of putting that is this story of the cheek,
of the cheek.
You give the other one. Which is always something that puzzled me, because of course most people cannot do that. But I think he was saying that out of his. Like you said, not of his relative being, but of his own inner being. And he could express that, I don't know in which circumstances, but of course that is the same, I would say. Mm-hmm. That he saw the aggressor as a reflection of himself.
Mm-hmm.
And it could be that he could also realize that he could be also the aggressor.
Mm-hmm.
And so I see it.
Yeah.
Because normally this duality is that you just see the other and you don't see yourself performing the same act.
Mm.
And when you say everything is included, yeah, in this sense we all can be the aggressor.
Absolutely.
And
that's right.
And that is the deepest meaning of all spiritual teachings, I think. I mean, it's not exclusive of Buddhism. That's
not
what
at all.
Say.
No. Not at all, absolutely. And all of the Christian, you know, Christ, love thy neighbor, do unto others as you would have them do unto yourself. You know, the thing of not throwing the first stone, before you throw the stone, you know, who threw the first one, all of these teachings. And not only Christian, as you say, absolutely. Or even recently, you know, I talked about this, Robert Thurman, who's the great Buddhist teacher, who recently died, and someone asked him about Trump. And he basically said, well, he has a lot of compassion for it. First he said, the guy asked him, what was Trump's past life? What was he in a previous life? Because the Tibetans have, you know, this thing of reincarnation. You know? And Thurman said, well, you know, from the way I see it, I think he must have been exceedingly generous in his previous life. Because he was born into wealth and, you know, had this great wealth already there. And so he must have been a generous person in his previous existence. And then, well, we see what happened. But then, so then Thurman said, but, you know, I have a lot of compassion for him. He goes into, you know, Trump's childhood and whatever. But he said, I could have known him. We're about the same age. We're both from New York, the same kinds of social circles, you know, born into privilege. I could be him. I could have been him, you know, which is like that, you know, saying, I could be that. This is great humility to say, I could be that, you know. When we go to Auschwitz, you know, I recommend everyone going to that Auschwitz retreat if you can afford it because it's really expensive, but... sitting on those, you know, those grounds for 5 days or whatever it is, you come to see that you also are that executioner. You know, you also have that potential. It's not only the victims that you identify with, but you also identify with the torturers, the guys up there in the guard towers, the people shoveling bodies into the ovens, you know. And this is, it sounds really conceptual, and it is, but believe me, when you go there, that experience happens. And that is what this is too, you know. I am that as well, yeah.
Our colleague said that Mao said kill the rich people. I don't know if you said that, in what context, but I know that they gave the emperor, Chinese emperor, an ordinary job. They gave to the emperor an ordinary job, a good opportunity to realize their true nature. I would like to, in this context, I would like to know your opinion about the role of violence in history, because in history...
Violence
in history. Because history is made of violence. I know that communism is not about killing people. It's about return the wealth to the ones that produce the wealth. But violence is part of history. Do you believe it's possible to have a change in society without violence? Any kind of violence?
Well, I don't know about belief or opinion. I don't really, I'm not sitting here to give beliefs or opinions. However, when we look at what the root of the violence is, of not seeing the true nature of being, and that was the Buddha's fundamental teachings, from that, from my experience, and in my just, you know, daily life, yes, I see that there is a potential to not be violent, right? Whether that can be, it can be realized. I also, my experience is that everyone can realize this. The Dalai Lama famously said that even Mao, because we're talking about Mao, that even Mao also has Buddha nature, which of course, but, and that he has the potential to realize it. He didn't, but he has the potential.
He had a Buddhist background.
He did, that's right. But clearly he didn't, for what he did, how he manifested in the world, in his daily activities, it shows that he didn't realize that. Although he was, you know, a Buddhist background, as many people in China. I have no doubt that everyone can realize that. Everyone has a potential. I can't say who will and who won't. You know, it's like the Indian... chief who his students, you know, what was it? He asked, you know, something like, how can you tell us where to find the true, the great being or something? Whatever in the Cree-Indian tradition, the equivalent of Buddha nature or something, or awakening. And he said, I can't tell you where it is or how to find it, but I can tell you where it isn't. And he said, it's right there, and he points like to a petrol station or something. You know. No, he said, it's like, I can't tell you where to find a buffalo, but I can tell you where it isn't. And he points to the petrol station. And that's the same thing here. I can tell you where it isn't, but I can't tell you where it is for you, you know? I can't say where, you know, even the Dalai Lama couldn't say where Mao would realize his true nature. And he had, you know, intimate relationship with Mao. He met him on several occasions, and it was because of Mao's activities that the Dalai Lama was forced to leave Tibet. But he, even then, he could not say how he would awaken, when he would awaken, if he would awaken, but he knew that he had the potential. And so there is a potential for nonviolence, absolutely.
This one thing that always comes, like with this question, is the cause is aggression, and aggression is one of the poisons of samsara, and it was said to me that I think the Buddha said samsara is endless until we made the decision to put an end to it. Mm-hmm. So I think the poisons will always be there as part of the manifestation.
True.
Until we decided to put an end to it. And the moment we put, then we don't see it anymore as well. Or we see it as...
But I think we are all in the process of becoming enlightened. We have the conditions. Some are favorable, some are unfavorable on our karma, our minds. So, you know, I've made some good comments in my mind, mocking fascists in a group, and some people thought that's not appropriate. You know, and I think I lost some friends, but you know, I was trying my best. Other people try their best. Even Mal probably tried his best. He thought he was doing the right thing. So you know, it's just the conditions we have. We don't see it clearly. Instantly, no? It's a process, I guess.
It's endless until you decide to finish. makes a point.
Another question associated with this is that there is different kinds of violence.
Mm-hmm.
Because in the moral sense, violence is not all the same. Because, for example, a slave that tries to liberate himself, he makes violence. It's not the same violence that all life is suffering. Because violence is, in the moral sense, is not all the same. It's different kinds of violence. This is part of the reflection about violence. Not all the violence is the same thing.
May I make a comment to react to what you said? You said communism is about distributing wealth to the people who generated it. I think that there's a lot of wisdom in looking at the ecological movement and saying all of us, whether it's all of the isms, we're all so human-centric, but we don't see the unity. And what we need here is to understand it's not about... I mean, when we distribute to man, we're really still robbing nature. So we have to reconceive everything.
Well, you know, so I mean, these are like ideological questions. And it is true that we do need to, that's what we're doing here. It's like we are looking into, so what is the essence? You know, where does this, if you come down to I like to say the lowest common denominator. Sometimes we think the lowest common denominator is the worst thing, right? But for me, I love the lowest common denominator. It's where everything is comes together, right? So, what did you say? I was going to answer that. The violence. Okay. Yeah, so of course there's different kinds of violence. And like we said yesterday about Odysseus, you know, or we say we're doing a violence to our body when we're trying to kill the cancer. It's true, there's different kinds of violence. The basic... underlying core of it, violence comes with two, right? There's a separation there. You need two to tango, as we say, you know? So it's always about two. There's always about a separation involved in the violence. And at sometimes it's appropriate, the slave to free himself or herself, yes. So then we can say it's an appropriate use of it. But the slave is really... you know, a victim of this deep world of form that discriminates, you know, this deep system of separation and making judgments and differentiations between skin color or role in society or whatever. So, of course, in order to break free of that, they have to do that within the culture that they're in, which may require some violence. And then when they become free... So this is kind of a good metaphor, because we all are slaves to this status quo within ourselves that we're imposing on ourselves. We have this boss who is our, you know, trained, conditioned self who's telling us what to do and not to do all the time, and who to be and who not to be. So the point of this practice is to be that slave that rises up and overthrows that status quo, that does violence to yourself, in a sense, if you want to see it that way, to overthrow that regime that is oppressing us within ourselves, right? Of course, it's oppressing us on a societal level, but it's oppressing us within ourselves. And it's because there's a separation. Once we've overthrown it, we see, well, it's the same self. You know, it's just a different aspect of ourself, per se, something like that. In the relative world, it is time for lunch. In the absolute world, nobody's hungry, there's no food, no time, but time to eat. So, thank you. So, after we chant and do the bowing, everyone disappears and we have to wait then a few minutes before the oryoki. So, maybe we should do a fast kinhin if everyone's going to do that. Right? Well, everyone goes off and goes to the toilet or something. Yesterday there were like three of us in here waiting for people to come back for oryoki to start. So I don't know how urgent it is for everyone to go to the toilet. Or can we just go to oryoki right away?
I need to go to the toilet.
Okay, well, let's try it again. Go to oryoki right away. If you need to go out, go quickly.
Sentient beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to put an end to them. Reality